To me, club fitting is A&F, airborne and forward. If you're not getting the ball up in the air, we're not going to be successful. And if it's going sideways, we're not going to be successful. So I was concentrating on A&F. And because I had a statistics-oriented background, I kept data all the time on what I was doing. I just didn't accept common ways of club fitting there was. I would do studies to figure out how I could be more effective. And one evening, I went back to my little shop, and on a yellow pad, I sketched out what in my mind now became the club that I wanted to have my customers have so I could sell a service. And it just came to me. I can't describe it. I've been thinking about it for a long time. And as I sketched it out, I wrote underneath it, tight lies.
Golf Smarter, number 784, is brought to you by Get Mister, the first dermatologist-developed health brand helping men build their healthiest skin without the hassle of a multi-step routine. Visit GetMister.com and use Golf Smarter to unlock the limited-time exclusive offer of 25% off your first purchase. That's G-E-T-M-R. GetMister.com and use coupon code GOLFSMARTER so that you can use the daily from GetMister, hashtag everydamnday. Barney Adams, creator of Tight Lies on the state of the game, equipment, the wow factor, and his newest venture.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing stories, tips, and insights from great golf minds to help you lower your score and raise your golf IQ. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast, Barney.
Hi, Fred. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thank you for joining me today. It's an honor to speak to you again. It's been almost 9 years, and I'm just so excited that you're still involved in the golf community. I've been actually quoting that conversation for years because we talked about play it forward.
Yeah, it's interesting because, in all honesty, I still don't think it's very well understood. And I see what I consider to be egregious. I'll tell you about a conversation. It just happened, I don't know, 2 or 3 days ago. The guy said you just disappeared on me. Hello?
Yeah, everything. I'm still here. I just turned off the camera.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay, fine. I didn't know something went wrong. Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
Anyway, we were talking about it, and the subject of I think it was a 360-yard par four came up, and the comment was, oh, if you know, you have all those little dinky holes like that, and you know, you're going to ruin the game, blah, blah, blah. That was the gist of the conversation. And I said, well, let's just look into that a little bit deeper. I said, let's take a 360-yard par four. Now, we'll assume that it's fairly flat for the sake of argument, because it could be straight up or straight down. That would change everything. But the average golfer, not when I'm talking about the average golfer, I'm talking about the people who support the game, the club members, the public course players, not the scratch golfers, not the tour players, but the vast majority of people. And I think the average handicap, at least for males, is I don't know, it's in the high teens, I think, or something like that. You know, we're not talking about exquisite players. And their average tee shot, by studies done by other people, is approximately 190 yards. They think it's 220, but I'm sorry, it's about 190. Now, if they got a course with, you know, 50, 60 yards rollout, that's a different story. But I'm going on averages here. So 190 into this little dinky 360-yard par four leaves a shot of 170 yards. Now, the architect who did this, being very clever, put a nasty little pot bunker on the right side of the green and allows the people that set the course up to move the pin on the green in behind that pot bunker. So it requires a skilled shot up in the air with spin to stop to get the ball close to the pin. That's good architecture. The only problem is this average person who is financially supporting the game, it's got 170 yards left, and he cannot hit the ball up in the air 170 yards with spin. He hits something, whether it's a hybrid or a fairway wood, that's low, what we call a low bullet type of shot. And his entry into the green is much less wide than the green is itself, because part of it he can't carry. So he's got less skill hitting a harder shot, and a miss hit by him nine times out of 10 is a worse lie than the good player gets. It's all negative. And that's my point. I'm talking to this guy and I'm saying, you're describing this 360 yard hole as being this little dinky piece of cake. That's not true. And people just don't understand that.
Yeah. I think the biggest problem with golf may be ego.
Yeah. Ego or I don't know, bad training. I don't know what it is. Because I've got to be honest. The PGA of America doesn't get this either. I've talked to many, many club pros, and I kind of led them into this subject that they don't understand. You know, they relate to what they can do. Well, they're good players, 99% of them. You know, they have to be to have the job. And they just, they don't understand that from 170 yards out, hitting the ball up into the air with spin isn't a shot that they have. And as a result, but these are they're strong influencers, and they don't really understand it. So, and kind of a funny part of it, but part B to this is all my years in the business, it seemed like every 3, 4, 5 years, you'd hear the women are coming. The women are going to, you know, take over this game by storm. There's millions of them out there and they're getting ready to play. I can remember at least 2 or 3 companies, equipment companies that started up to make just women's golf clubs. And they lasted not very long at all, because the women never came. And my theory is the reason that the women never came is that they are smarter than men. And they're not going to go out and sweat and get frustrated and roll the ball along the ground for some, you know, 9 holes or 18 holes, whatever it is. They got better things to do with their time. And that's why you don't see them out there. And I don't think you will see them out there.
Wow. That's a harsh criticism of the game.
I'll keep going when I'm on a roll here.
Yes, you are.
Golf is marketed. You see this all the time. Golf is marketed as being fun. Golf is not fun. Golf is hard. And as a result, it's incredibly rewarding. You want to try something when you have people on your show. Ask them what the best shot they hit in their last round was. Think of it for yourself. What was the best shot you hit? Almost always, there's a little bit of a grin and an answer. Because we don't hit a whole lot of good shots, but when we hit that one good one, whether it's a chip or a putt or a drive or whatever it is, we remember it. It's rewarding, and it's the rewarding factor that brings people back to the game over and over again. It's not because they're dominating the game by any stretch of the imagination.
No, people don't talk about the good part of their game. They always complain about that 3-putt or the time they got stuck in a bunker. They right?
Well, they remember that, but they'll also remember that one solid shot that they hit, because we don't hit a lot of them. We don't hit a lot of solid shots, but when we do, it registers. And that rewarding factor, I believe, is one of the strongest things that keeps people playing. Because, I mean, if you could, calling it as it is, we go out and on a repetitious basis, you know, fail. That's what golf does to you. You know, you don't make good scores and by par and so on. You just go out and the game kicks your butt and you go home and you complain and you come back 2 days later. Well, it's the rewarding factor. We don't get to do things that have such a high degree of great feeling for that 1 or 2 good shots.
Right. Well, think about when maybe somebody shoots a 59 on the tour and the post-round interview, they talk about the putt they missed. They talk frustration.
Yeah, right, could have been 58. Well, another subject. The tour.
The woulda, shoulda, coulda.
The tour, is misunderstood. The tour is television entertainment. It's like a hit television show. You take TV away from the tour, you got nothing. You don't have a tour. TV is all about the tour. Since it's all about this, the tour is all about TV. I said it backwards, sorry. And because of that, the TV people know to highlight and focus on things that viewers like to see. And it's just good programming. It's good managing. But it isn't golf as we know golf. It's television. It's golf televised to be spectacular.
No question. And it's actually, I think golf on television is one of the better sports on television, and I would much rather watch TV, watch golf on TV than be out there live, because I get to see everything when I'm watching it on TV. When I'm there, it feels like everything is happening somewhere else.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm the same way. I would much rather watch. I can remember going to the British Open one year and watching most of it on television because I wanted to see the tournament. And there, you know, 98 gazillion people there, and you're, you know, 14 deep in a hole and so on. You know, you don't see very much. So we prepared to a nice lounge with TVs all over the place and had a great time watching the tournament.
So interesting. And how are you feeling about bifurcation and making rule changes that affect the tour but not affect the average golfer?
I'm against it. I think one of the great things about golf is that with our relative degrees of inability, we can play the same club, the same ball, the same golf course. And I just think that's a bond there that you leave alone. It's the television. I go back to TV. Golf TV is very successful. Leave it alone. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
What about the, you know, the talk about, you know, like when Tiger came around, they, all the conversation was, let's make courses longer. Let's make courses longer. Well, now they're running out of real estate. And so the conversation is, how do we pull the players back with equipment and balls?
Do you want to? I mean, do you have to? Because, again, go back to what I was saying. It's good television.
Yeah.
Well, what do people like to watch on TV? What do you think they have Top Golf for, that, you know, that laser thing, which is really fun to watch? What do you think have the lines in the fairway showing this drive went, you know, 332 yards and this one went 498 yards or whatever the heck it is? That's television entertainment, and that's what we enjoy watching. So why change that? Leave it alone. I mean, there's ways you can change it. You can, for example, if I were made czar tomorrow, which is absolutely never going to happen, but I mean, just hypothetically, and I had to do something, I would increase the spin rate of the golf ball. In the old days, for me, which goes back a long time, fades off the tee did not go very far. They were soft shots. If you wanted to hit the ball a long way, you had to, what we call, turn it over. You had to hook it. And the problem with hooks is sometimes they don't listen very well. They get away from you. It required a great level of skilled shot making to hit hooks that would go a long way and be in play. But what you see today are these bombers lining up on the left side of the tee box, hitting fades, which are very much in control, hitting the fairway, rolling out a long way. And those are some of the really long bombs. You don't see a lot of hookers anymore, because they're taught to hit fades because they're in better control. So I say, all right, if I have to do something, which I don't want to do, but if I have to do something, I'll make the golf ball like it was a long time ago, and because the old Bellotta balls spun more than today's golf balls, and your fades will be softer. They won't roll out like they do now, and you'll say you'll have to turn it over to hook it. And for those of us, the great masses that are, you know, playing amateur golf, it's not going to make a heck of a lot of difference, because the extra spin isn't going to have a detrimental effect or a positive effect as far as that goes on our game. So if I had to do something, it was just me speculating, you know, if I had to do something, that's what I'd do.
There's more to talk about this. I have so many more questions for you about this. We'll do that when we come back after we hear from our new sponsor, Get Mister.
Get Mister, is that, sounds like a TV show.
No, Get Mister is not a TV show. It's actually a great new product that I'm happy to be sharing with the Golf Smarter community. Listen, I don't shave every day. Frankly, I don't enjoy shaving. But when I grow a beard like I did at the beginning of quarantine lockdown, it looks like I have this white halo around my face. One day on a Zoom call, I was wearing a baseball cap, and when I saw myself in grid view, I looked like an older Ernest Hemingway, which is not a good look for me. And frankly, my wife says I look like an old man with a beard, and she hates it, so that's a hard no. Now, in the past, after shaving, I use a shave gel that feels good and smells nice. But it ended there. No moisturizer, no sunscreen. Unless I'm playing golf. Yet, like most guys, I'm pretty lazy when it comes to skincare. That's why I'm so happy that I was introduced to The Daily by Get Mister. The Daily is the first FDA-registered moisturizer, aftershave, and safe SPF 30 sunscreen, dermatologist-developed product just for men. As someone who's always a fan of form and function, I love the pop-up container. But more importantly, I feel so much better knowing that I'm getting an aftershave, moisturizer, and sunscreen without the hassle of an annoying multi-step routine. And here's why you should check out The Daily by Get Mister right now. They're offering the Golf Smarter community 25% off your first purchase when you go to getmister.com. That's GETMR.com. And use the checkout code GOLFSMARTER. Look better, protect your face, and allow your skin to look younger than it has in years. This 25% discount is an exclusive limited-time offer. So get over there right now. Use GOLFSMARTER at checkout when you go to GETMR.com and use The Daily, hashtag every damn day. When I discuss play it forward, and I try to explain play it forward to people, what I tell them is that think about when you're watching the guys, the big boys, play on tour, they're going to hit driver and wedge. Driver or anything under an 8-iron, right? 8-iron, 9-iron, wedge. We, if we played the same course, same hole, but played maybe on the blue tees or the white tees, we're going to hit driver hybrid or driver, you know, a 5-iron. Why can't we also hit that 8-iron on the second shot? Why do we have to, you know, struggle as much if we want to play golf like the big boys? Am I misinterpreting that?
No, not at all. That's exactly what I've written before, and that's exactly what I tell people. If we're hitting wedges on par fours, it's for a third shot or fourth shot. It isn't for our second shot. And the game that the average amateur plays is just nothing like the tour player. I'm sorry, but it's, I happen to play in a game here in the desert where I live at a course which is known for having very, very good players. And we have a game at 11 o'clock, and they allow me to play. I'm not a good player at all, but they kind of let me sneak in the edge of the game, so to speak. And, you know, I try.
That's because you're a legend, Barney.
Yeah, right. I try and stay out of people's ways and so on. But we got these young kids, you know, it's probably half a dozen kids that are just dying to go on tour, and they work on their game and so on and so forth. They hit it 100 yards past everybody else. You know, they're hitting it 330. And it's just not even, it's funny. It's such a difference. So, and one of the things this course does, and I give them a lot of credit, by the way, we have four sets of tees. We might have a foursome and play four different tees. It's all about you'll get your handicap, is correlated to the tee you play from. And that makes the game very, very good. I have a lot of admiration for the way they run it. I really admire the way they run the game.
That's great. Yeah. I'm playing, you know, usually I'll play the whites and I'm like, how come you're not playing farther back? It's like, because I want to have fun. It's more fun for me if I'm scoring better. So why do you care? I'm not playing for money.
It's more rewarding for you. You get a chance to play the hole the way the architects designed it. I wrote a story about that recently. I'm saying the same thing over and over again, trying to figure out some way to, you know, get the message across. And this one was from the viewpoint of the architect. We talk about golf architects. We write about them, we kind of idolize them, you know, their great skills and so on and so forth, and we don't play the courses the way they design them. Come on, guys. I mean, the architect is not designing a par four that's a minimum three-shot hole. He's standing on the green, figuring about where you're going to be coming into the green from, and he's putting hazards around and so on, except for the fact that we're not playing it that way. Let's honor the architects by playing from the tees that reward the holes for the way they're designed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So how can we, or can this play it forward concept evolve into something that makes sense to every person who's out there just trying to have a good time?
No clue.
Okay.
Donna, I wrote the original story 8 or 9 years ago, and it's still misunderstood. I do not think the name Play It Forward is doing it a great deal of value, because what it's really about is second shots. I don't care where you play it from. That doesn't make it, you know, that's, I would say, irrelevant, but that's not the main thing. The main thing is, where are you playing? You, like you just said, you play the white tees because you end up in a position where you can hit the ball up into the air onto the green. It's about where you're playing your second shot from. That's why you play the white tees. So if anything, I would emphasize the second shots, and I would emphasize, as I said before, honoring the architects.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Tell me about the book, The Wow Factor.
Well, I get asked all the time. You got to understand, living out here in the California desert where I am one of and surrounded by golf nuts. This is golf nut heaven out here.
Yes,
so I am continually asked about, how did you get in the golf business? Because, you know, I guess they would like to ask anybody in the golf business that question. But, you know, what was your background? Were you a golf pro or an assistant pro, or, you know, blah, blah, blah. And my answer is, always was, it's such a long, convoluted answer that I just, you know, I can't do it justice, you know, walking down the fairway or wherever we are. And I ended up writing a book on the subject. And that's how the book came about, because it is a convoluted answer. And then when I was writing the book, one of my objectives was to make it a golf story, but also a story about entrepreneurism at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's how it came about.
I see. Well, you created a revolution in the game by introducing tight lies.
Yep.
Can you give me a little bit of history on that one?
And I was a club fitter back in the early 90s, when club fitting was either not done or barely done and so on. And it wasn't like I was any great prognosticator of the future. I fit golf clubs because I had a line of clubs I was trying to sell. And I had learned some lessons. Initially, I tried to sell the product being the golf clubs. And I couldn't give them away. They were good. They had nothing to do with it. It's just that I wasn't getting the message across. So I started offering the service of custom fitted golf clubs. And that in turn allowed me to at least get a reasonable amount of sales. So I learned one lesson, which I emphasize in the book, is that you don't sell a product, you sell a service. And if you're really good, you figure out what your service is and emphasize the service, which will in turn enhance your product sales. Hmm. And so that environment was, you know, what I was working at. Now, in doing that, the common complaint was, gee, Barney, I hope you got something that could help me with my fairway woods. I just can't hit them. You know, I roll them along the ground and so on and so forth. Well, number one, back in those days, the deep face driver was kind of, I'll say dominant, but certainly prevalent at the very least. And in those days, fairway woods were kind of like a family of drivers. You know, whatever your driver looked like, your fairway woods looked like the same thing with more loft. A little bit different, but pretty much. So as a result, the fairway woods were fairly deep face. And number one, that's intimidating to a lot of people with the ball sitting on the ground. Number two, because they are deep face, the center of gravity is fairly high. And it's a hard club to hit, unless you've got a lot of club head speed and hit it just right and so on. So my fairway woods that I was trying to fit them with did not do the job. And I thought, it didn't take me long to figure that out. So I said, I got to look around. And I went to retail stores and stuff just to look at designs to see what design kind of said, yeah, that's the way to do it and so on. And I couldn't find anything. And so this thought kind of, you know, I've spent hours, roughly 10 hours a day from 2 in the afternoon to 10 at night on this driving range where I was custom fitting. And this thought was always going through my mind. How am I going to help the people hit their second shot off the ground? Because to me, club fitting is A&F, airborne and forward. I know that sounds like a silly statement, but if you stop and think about it, if you're not getting the ball up in the air, we're not going to be successful. And if it's going sideways, we're not going to be successful. So I was concentrating on A&F. And because I had a statistics-oriented background and techie-oriented background, I kept data all the time on what I was doing. I just didn't accept whatever common ways of club fitting there was. I would do studies to figure out how I could be better, how I could be more effective. And in that, one evening, instead of going home, it was about 10:30 at night, and I had a little shop in the area that I would get to at 8 in the morning, and that's where I would make the clubs that I was fortunate enough to sell and so on. So it was, you know, one end or the other of the operation. I went back to my little shop, and on a yellow pad, as I say, we didn't exactly have computers, or we were lucky we had a phone, as a matter of fact. So on a yellow pad, I sketched out what in my mind now became the club that I wanted to have my customers have so I could sell a service. And it just came to me. I can't describe it, but I've been thinking about it for a long time. And as I sketched it out, I wrote underneath it, tight lies. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't know where that came from outside of the fact that in trying to, again, help customers, certainly the tighter the lie, the more difficult the problem, the more visually difficult it was and so on. I had a source in Taiwan at the time that I knew made clubs, sent them my sketch by fax. About 8 weeks later, my first samples came. I took them back to the range, shafted them up, gave them to my customers to hit, and they loved them. And what I noticed was when they would hit balls with them, they would go, wow, I can get this up in the air. Wow, this is really good. And wow became the title of my book, The Wow Factor, because I'm a firm believer that in your product has got to have a wow. Whatever it is, I don't care if it's a shirt or a golf club or face cream, you know, whatever it is, it's got to have a wow. And the tight lies definitely had a wow, and I was very pleased. I thought I had done my job, and life was going on. I was, you know, went back to custom fitting, and the product kind of took a life of its own. We would get phone calls. I say we. I had three employees. We would get phone calls, and it would be like, I played golf with Fred the other day, and he hit a shot at number. He ain't that good. What was that thing he's hit there, that tight thing or whatever it is, can I get one? And variations of that theme. And that never happened to us before. And from there, we graduated into figuring out a way to get our product into the retail stores, because that was the market in those days. And the retail stores wouldn't talk to us because, and this is another lesson I learned, golf clubs are not sold. Golf clubs are bought. Big difference.
Big difference.
When something is bought, you've got to incent the buyer. First of all, you've got to know who it is. You've got to have a mental picture, and you've got to know who the buyer is. You've got to incent them to go someplace. We didn't have the internet in those days for, you know, buying online. So you've got to incent them to go someplace where the product is and ask for it. It's a marketing business. The four main companies in the golf equipment business today are Payne, Callaway, Titleist, and TaylorMade. The four main companies in the golf equipment business 30, 40 years ago were Payne, Callaway, Titleist, and TaylorMade. And I'm talking about like an 85% market share. Mm-hmm. Why? because it's a marketing business. They spend tens of millions of dollars a year on marketing. They're wonderful at it. They've learned the lessons over the years. They know what works. They know what to stay away from. And that means when, you know, Joe Smith comes up with a great idea for a golf club or golf clubs, you know, he can't break in. It's too darn hard. As an example, a case in point, there has never been an independent putter company in the history of the golf industry that hasn't disappeared. You know, I don't care how good your putter is, you're selling against the Ping putters, the Callaway putters, the Titleist putters, the TaylorMade putters. Good luck.
Yeah, and if it's that good, they're going to be bought by Ping, Callaway, TaylorMade, and Titleist.
Yeah, they are, but
they're going to get scooped up.
Even then, that doesn't happen very often because those companies have got rooms full of engineers that they're paying come up with designs, and they're very good and they're extremely competent, and they've got artificial intelligence today and so on. And so you may be as good, but you aren't better. And it's just so difficult. I have people that call me for advice on getting into the golf equipment business. I tell them not to do it. And of course, that doesn't make them happy because they're passionate about what they're doing. I understand, but they call me, they're going to get a straight answer, and I just give them examples of how difficult it is.
Yeah. Well, there's a new wow coming, and we're going to talk about it right after this. You mentioned that it's service, but service isn't scalable as product is, and you put out a product that was scalable that became Adams Golf, that was Titleist, that became very successful. So before the internet, service businesses was a hard thing to grow like that, though, right? Would you agree?
I agree, but you, for example, you told me you were, I think you were in the video business, you made videos for people and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Your product isn't your videos. Your product is this quality of your videos. Your product is convincing me, the customer, that you're able to get the message across in a way that's going to be extremely effective.
Yeah, good point.
Think of it that way, but that's
what it is.
Right. Because I can get a camera. I can do a video. Boom, I aim the camera, pull the trigger. You know, there's a video. But compared to what you do, you know, it's irrelevant.
Yeah, even now it's crazier. You just pull out your phone and start shooting.
Yeah,
video.
That's right. That's right. Technology. And by the way, it won't be very long before we can ask one of our robots to do it for us. We'll just sit there and watch it be done and so on.
Yep.
But does not mean it's going to reach the soul of the intended recipient and get the kind of message across that you want to get across.
Excellent point. Well, you're getting back into the product business.
I did not say I was smart.
But you're hooked.
Yeah, I am. I'm a junkie. I'll admit it. I'm a junkie. You know, when I started Adams Golf, I was 50 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'll tell you a story. You didn't ask me, but I'll tell you anyway. What the heck?
Please do.
What about the golf business? My first day. Now, there's a backstory to this, and we had another little business that I was helping, and their backers ran into some financial trouble, and it was going to get closed down, and I ended up with the assets and bought, you know, for nothing. And my plan was to start up on my own, and I knew that I needed some cash to do that. I didn't have any money. I never had any money. I knew I needed cash to do that, and we actually landed a contract, this is a long, long time ago, with TV to just make a set of clubs for TV, sold them inexpensively, but it was a cash flow thing. And I was slowly building up cash to go in and use that as the reservoir to start on my own. So that, cut to the chase, that happens. So now I've left my other job. My belongings literally were in my automobile. That's all I had. And I drove to, this was in Texas. I left the Silicon Valley, drove to Texas to start up on my own. Checked into the Days Inn Motel, which was next door to the local cafeteria. which opened up, I think, at 5 a.m. I had a breakfast that day, and I was so excited. I can remember to this day. I mean, I'm finally going to be in the golf business on my own. And I got into this little building that we had. I probably arrived there before 6 a.m. Of course, nobody else was there. First order of business for me was to get a place to hang my hat, as it were. We had a bunch of old desks that came with the building, so I just picked one, and very carefully, I was going to go through the drawers because our building was in the middle of a field, and you had to be very careful about who took up residence with you that you necessarily didn't want. And some of them had stingers, and some of them had a little poison in them, and so on. So you very carefully went through a desk and make sure it was cleaned out and so on, which is what I was doing. Lower left-hand drawer was full of paper, and I grabbed it, and I thought, how the heck did that get in there? Anyway, I was going to drew the basket over and started to throw it away, and noticed the top page had a current date, and it was a demand notice. And the bottom line was that I had done a very, very poor job of overseeing the cash flow, even though it wasn't all that much money, over the last year as I was trying to raise money. And instead of having a bank account to go forward on, I was in debt to every supplier for more money, cumulative, than I thought we had saved. I had nothing, absolutely nothing. And I cannot adequately explained the depth of pain that hit me when it got through my thick head that's what happened. It was like a crushing blow, so to speak. And I reacted very maturely. I punched the wall and broke my finger, threw my briefcase against the wall, had a tantrum the whole bit, and then calmed down and, said, all right, it is what it is. This is your fault. You did a lousy job of paying attention, so you get what you deserve. Now, what are you going to do? I immediately knew I couldn't quit, because most of these people we owed money to were the same people that I would plan on dealing with, in the foreseeable future. So I ended up writing them all a letter telling them exactly what happened, telling them not to come after me for the money because I don't have any. But if they stick with me, they'll get their money back. And at the same time, when I was cleaning up the mess from throwing my briefcase against the wall, there was a checkbook. And it had checks in it, and it had a balance. It was a solicitation for credit card. Congratulations, Mr. Adams. You now have a balance. I think it was $5,000. And it might have been more than that. It might have been 10,000. I don't know what it was. But, anytime you want to activate this card, just write a check and so on. So I did. And that started my financing program, which lasted with me for many years. I got up to 43 credit cards. I ran my own Ponzi scheme. And I would never stiff anybody. It was all legal. And I would just, if I owed the guy $100, I'd pay him 40 and borrow the money for the 40 and then just keep the scheme going until such time that fortunately things worked out. But no normal human being would do that. Mm. And that's my theory of entrepreneurism. Most entrepreneurs are borderline. Wow. Silicon Valley, yeah, you got tens of millions of dollars behind you, and you're a genius IQ and all that. That's a different world. I'm talking about the little guys. You just right. don't do it. I look back on my early days at Adams, and I thought, there's no way I would do that. There's absolutely no way. It was absolutely crazy.
So tell me about Breakthrough Golf Technology, your new venture here.
Well, we were kept in touch with some people, and I was talking to this guy, and he was going to start a putter company. And like referring to our earlier conversation, I said, there's never been an independent putter company in the history of the golf industry that hasn't disappeared. You cannot fight the big guys. Now today we have an internet. So instead of going out of business, they can set up a website and sell a product on the internet. And some of them can, you know, supplement their income. I don't know if they make an income. They certainly don't have a significant market share, but they're not dead. They're alive. But it's not a success. So in talking, he was showing me the numbers from his putting, and he was explaining that there was this aberration in the numbers, so something that was supposed to go from X to Y and perform in a certain way, and there'd be a blip. And again, making a long story short, we ascertained that the blip was caused by the shaft. The shaft was actually oscillating very, very slightly during the stroke. And if you think about it, putters, going back to my early days, were blades and, say, then the bullseyes, and even Karsten's early heel-toe weighted putters. They were light, relatively speaking. And today's putter heads, because of the influence of heel-toe weighting, are much, much heavier, like twice as heavy. Well, with all of the improvements, with all of the technology that's into the golf equipment business, one thing hasn't changed: the putter shaft. So the putter shaft is essentially 70 years old or longer, whatever it is. And yet the putter heads have changed drastically. And the putter shaft responds by oscillating very, very, very slightly, just a little shimmy, so to speak. You can't feel it or see it. We ended up contracting a NASA camera to look for it so we could design around it for the new shaft. And what it does is, if the shaft oscillates very slightly, that means the head oscillates very slightly, and that precludes the head from coming back to the golf ball perfectly square. And the cornerstone for good putting, I don't care who you work with or what system you use, your putter face has got to be square to the golf ball at impact. So once we realized that, we were able to find out in the shaft where the oscillation was occurring, design around it, and design a shaft that didn't oscillate. Now, two things. One is, you could fix that problem immediately by making the shaft heavier and wider. Simple fix. The problem is that you as a golfer would have to adjust to that. That's a big adjustment. You can't have an adjustment that's greater than the problem you're trying to fix in the first place.
Yeah.
And that's what it would have been. So we had to make a shaft that weighed the same, balanced the same, felt good, and yet didn't oscillate. That took a couple of years. That's a very, very difficult product. And that's the product we sell today. We're just a tiny little company. We don't have any marketing money. We don't have any big guys, you know, throwing money at us. We live online. We tell our story. And I'm very, very clear to people. I had a YouTube thing done because I wanted to get this message out. Don't buy our shaft and think that you're just going to go out and start making everything, because you're not. This is putting. You know, it's a very, very precise, the slightest piece of grass can throw your ball off or whatever. We know that just because of data collection, that over time, you will putt better. Now, what's the definition of putting better? I don't know. Maybe you make one more 10-footer around. Maybe you don't three putt as much. I don't know, because I don't know what your starting point is. But I do know that you will putt better, but it is not some miraculous. Trust me, I've had horrible putting days with that shaft, you know, where I've looked at it and threatened its life two or three times. But that's human beings, you know, what can I say?
Right.
And we sell it primarily online, Breakthrough Golf Tech, and we're working on a couple other things. I get kidded about it all the time because I'm the one that, you know, talks about the insanity of the entrepreneur and so on. And here I am doing it again, but that's what I was. That's what I am. What can I say? It is what it is.
So it could be for any skill level of golfer.
Yeah,
it's
sure.
It's a commitment. And it works on any putter head?
Yeah, sure. Any putter head. That's part of the engineering. You know, you got to make it easy to assemble. You got to make it easy to straightforward, you know, you don't want to have a specialist. The only three guys in town know how to do it, you know, that kind of stuff. It's very mm-hmm. easy to put on any putter head. You can take your putter in and have the R shaft put on your putter. To probably, you know, it takes a guy 5 minutes to do it right. It's nothing.
I generally use a 33-inch putter. Would that work for me, or would what is the length of your shaft?
I don't care if you use a 23-inch putter. The golf ball doesn't know. All the golf ball knows is this object that's coming towards it, and if you want the golf ball to go in the exact direction that you're hoping for, then the object has got to strike it square to that direction. If the object is slightly off one way or the other, it's going to affect where the golf ball goes. He doesn't care if your shaft is 33 inches or if it's an arm lock or you're standing on your head. Make any difference.
Right, but is the shaft come in various lengths, or does it need to be cut down? And if it is cut down, does that impact the effectiveness?
No, it's designed so that you can adjust it significantly and not affect the engineering to mitigate the oscillation.
I see. And let's take a quick time out. This week on number 100 of Golf Smarter Mulligans and the third of 9 consecutive episodes featuring my interviews with the late Tony Manzoni. Learn about Tony at our website at golfsmarter.com/Tony. His book, The Lost Fundamental, One Simple Move, Better Golf Forever, is available on Amazon, and his DVD of the same name can now only be seen online through our private channel. To gain access, please write to me directly via email, golfsmarterpodcast@gmail.com, or click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com. And if you do write to me and don't get a quick response, it's only because there's something wrong with your email address and my response bounced back, and then I can't reach back to you. Based on the emails that have been coming in, even the Golf Smarter veterans are still picking up helpful tips by hearing Tony's instruction once again. Like this sample from this week's episode.
The less you emphasize putting, the better you'll putt. The more you talk about it and think about it, I think it puts a block. I think with Hogan, he hit it so close in his later years, and he felt like he should be rewarded for that. And I think that's what happened with Hogan. He made statements that said putting shouldn't be so important. You should get points just for getting it close to the hole. Well, that was his frustration coming out, because he did hit it so close. And unfortunately, he did have the yips. He couldn't pull a putter back on a short putt. The only time I had the pleasure of seeing him play golf, and at the Olympic Club, he played the Open. And, I mean, he hit every fairway, every green, and I don't think he had more than a 12-foot putt all day. And the only putts he made were kick-ins. But when he got that 4 or 5 footer, his pant leg would be shaking. He couldn't pull the putter back.
Wow.
Now you think about that. This is a guy that could go in a motel and hit a 2-iron right down the hallway and not hit either side.
That's the first of 2 consecutive episodes called Play Golf at the Next Level, One Club at a Time, on Golf Smarter Mulligans, featuring our third of 9 interviews with Tony Manzoni, the most responded to teacher ever featured on our podcast. Both Golf Smarter and Golf Smarter Mulligans are free and available wherever you get your podcasts. Please follow both so that you can get the brand new episode of either when it downloads to your favorite listening device. Another thing that's changed significantly in the last decade or so with putters is the putter grips.
Mm-hmm.
No problem there.
No,
but any putter grip.
Sure. Look at the little. I bet you, if you stop and think about this, you can have a visual of a touring pro, and you look at their putter, and he's got 19 wraps of something looks like masking tape or something on the grip of his putter. You know, he's just done it to the point where it feels like, and it's just now that they're engineered that way going in, and they're much more consistent.
Very interesting, and again, it's not going to matter whether it's a blade or a mallet or like the lab golf putters, the DF2, which I was using for a while, and somebody said, "Oh, you got the Starship Enterprise there."
Yeah, right. That's what I mean. I actually, they sent me. I don't know who it was. They sent me one, And they explained to me, you know, it's how I kind of get a kick on the deflection angle thing, you know, where the weight is distributed towards the heel and the toe, which mitigates the face deflection on off-center hits. It doesn't eliminate it. It minimizes it. So what that means is you miss closer.
Okay. You know. If you're going to miss, you're going to miss closer.
Yeah, both putts were good, but that's okay. I mean, this, you know, so pick it up, Barney, that's close enough, you know. But it's, you know, one is 8 inches and one is 4 inches or whatever.
Right, right. Well, that's, again, it's at breakthroughgolftech.com. If you're interested in looking into these new stability putters, it's a fascinating concept. It makes a lot of sense, but it's don't expect to, like Barney says, don't expect to put one in your hand and think they're all going to start dropping. You got to work
say,
on it.
Didn't you say you had one?
No, I do not.
Oh, you don't? You ought to get in touch with Mary Beth. She'll get you one.
Okay.
She knows
maybe
how to do it.
I would love to do that.
But you got to lose. You know, she'll get you one. Don't use me. Listen, I can't turn the computer on, so don't use me.
Barney, it was great to talk to you again. I know you got a birthday coming up soon. I wish you nothing but good health and long life. Congratulations on some really interesting success, and I really appreciate your time today.
Sure. Where do you play golf out there?
Oh, I play, I live in Marin County up here in Northern California. I play Rooster Run, Peacock Gap. I live right near Marin Country Club, which I'm not a member of.
Are they old courses? I don't remember
relatively. Yeah, there's not a lot of courses being built around here.
Well, yeah, with the cost of land, that's certainly understandable.
Yeah, in Northern California, absolutely. Yeah.
I played at Sharon Heights when I lived out there, which was, which I understand now. I haven't been there for years. It's a very tony, high end, expensive club, but it wasn't anything like that when I was there. I know that because I could afford to join. It was very inexpensive, and it was. I can remember going with some guys to play someplace, and we did, and we had a good time, and we decided to play another 9 or 18, and we couldn't get out. It was so crowded.
Wow.
And this guy said to me, he said, Barney, you ought to take a look at Sharon Heights. They're having a special. And I did. I drove over there that weekend and, you know, became a member. Met some very, very nice people, and you know, was I don't know, I was only there a couple, 3 years, but Sandhill, 3000 Sandhill looks right down on Sharon Heights.
Oh, okay. I know you're talking down in Silicon Valley area.
Yeah, it looks right down on the golf course. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And isn't it amazing what kind of impact COVID had on the growth of the game?
Who would have thought? Huh? I mean, who would have thought? We don't anymore, but we used to go up to the Santa Barbara area and, you know, get out. Well, my wife talked to me and explained to me that we're going to get out of the desert heat in the summertime. I actually liked it because we would play in the mornings, and I thought it was great. But anyway, we ended up in Santa Barbara, and there was in Carpinteria, there was a public, or public, of course, they're all public, a driving range. It was right out of, you know, the movies. It was an old trailer, and I mean, old trailer, and they had real grass, which was a big deal. And it wasn't limited distance, which was a big, big deal. Because, again, up there, the land is so precious, it's hard to give it all away to a golf driving range. And when I first went up there, I don't know, years ago, it was big, too. You could probably get 40 slots or so. I don't know, a lot. It was always empty. And when I say empty, there were maybe 6 or 8 people hitting balls. So you could go any place, hit golf balls. Just, you know, and the weather was beautiful. It was, you know, because you're hitting right towards the ocean, so a nice ocean breeze. It was wonderful. And golfers used to hang out there. You know, it was one of those places, so to speak. So last year was my last year up there. I remember driving down. There were people waiting in line. I couldn't get over that. There were people. It went from, you know, maybe 20% utilized to people waiting in line to hit golf balls. And they weren't golfers per se. They were families, you know, mom and dad and the kids. Right. And they had an easy chair, you know, a collapsible chair with them in a cooler, and watching the kids hit golf balls. It was something for them to do. And it was just amazing.
Got them out of the house as a group. Yeah.
Absolutely right. There's a guy here in town that's got a used club store. And I go in and talk to him once in a while, and I like to rummage around and look at stuff. And I remember I was there last spring. He was sold out. Sold out. He had never happened to him before in his life. He said, I can't get stuff to sell.
Yeah.
It's been an amazing phenomenon. I hope it sticks. I hope they don't figure there's something better to do.
I think there are a lot of golf course general managers that are freaking out because what do we do when this ends? How are we going to sustain this?
Exactly right. In fact, I got I don't think I wrote the story. I can't remember anymore, but I got asked that question to write about it. Okay, you got them. How do you keep them?
Right.
And that's a very interesting subject.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of scary for the world. Well, we went through it before when we had the Tiger effect. Now we got the COVID effect, you know, the up and the down. And
yeah, but the Tiger effect, I actually did study this. The Tiger effect didn't have the same results on club members that the COVID effect did. It wasn't even close. The National Golf Foundation, which is kind of the, you know, the gatekeeper, so to speak, had a category called avid golfers. And avid golfers were their definition, I know it was by age or something, I forget, but they knew who they were, what I'm trying to say. They could count them. And the avid golfers contributed 71% of all golf-related expenses. They were the people carrying the load. Whatever I don't remember how they defined it, but whatever it was, they were paying the bills. The study started in 98, I think, and showed roughly 7 million avid golfers. And it peaked in the 2000s, might have been 2010, at like 12 million avid golfers. And the last time I saw the report, there were 6.1 million avid golfers. And not only has COVID had a dramatic influence, but the game was losing people.
Yeah.
That's my point. And it was so bad that the National Golf Foundation discarded the category. They didn't want to talk about it.
Yikes.
Yeah, exactly. And you'll see the, they publish a figure that says there are 24 million golfers in the United States. Well, the definition of golfer in their study is age 6 and above that plays at least once a year. How about that for sinking your teeth into that to do some, you know, make some investments and so on.
Yeah.
So if we want to increase play, we'll just lower that age to 5 and above. And maybe instead of playing once a year, maybe they drive by a golf course once a year and so on. I mean, you got to bury your way through the numbers.
Right. So I guess that increase of 14% is kind of in 2020. That's what I read, that there was an increase in rounds of by 14%, that maybe it was a little fudged.
Well, as long as it's consistent, it doesn't make any difference. I don't care if they're all 6-year-olds, if they're out there playing and their dad was paying the bill and so on. Who cares, you know?
Yep. Well, they're on the tee sheets.
I think it's going to be very, very interesting to see if they stick with it, especially today. I mean, I'm kid about it, but it's also the truth. I'm an old fogey. I'm not up to speed on video games. I'm not up to speed on people wearing these glasses that, you know, can transport them into another alien warship war or some, you know, something like that. But those are incredibly powerful things to do with your time. And golf is slow. You get out there and it's, you know, you got to learn to do it, how to hold the club, what to do this, to that, and so on. I have fears that the increase won't last, is what I'm saying.
Hmm. All right, Barney, I've got to go. It's great to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time.
Sure. Next time you have 8 or 10 hours you want to spend with me, what the hell? I got nothing to do.
Let's do it.
Okay, thank you very much.
So I'm going to be taking a couple of weeks off visiting family, and the only reason I'm mentioning this is that I won't have a lot to report during this segment of the show, but I promise you won't miss a new interview on Golf Smarter or the continuation of Spring with Manzoni on Golf Smarter Mulligans while I'm away. So in the meantime, I've been recording some really interesting interviews, including a guy whose life was changed as a member of Tony Manzoni's golf team at College of the Desert. I can't wait to talk to him. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions on what you'd like to hear on an upcoming interview, I'd love to hear from you. Actually, I received an email this weekend from listener Dave Harms, who wrote, "Hey, Fred, found your podcast last year, and it's been a revelation. Could I get access to Tony's video, please? And if you get stuck for content, I'm thinking I haven't heard a show about the things you've learned over the years that have made a difference in your game. Maybe you could get Maddie B to interview you." Well, it's an interesting idea, not something I would have ever considered, because this show has always been about the info I can get from experts. So what do you think about it? Now, unless I get a lot of positive comments about doing something so self-indulgent, it's not going to happen. So hit me back with your thoughts. Follow at Golf Smarter in social media, subscribe to Golf Smarter TV on YouTube, or just click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.